Hello and welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. Our mission here is to offer hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. What follows is the audio from selected videos posted on Recovering from Religion's YouTube channel. So sit back, relax, and enjoy.
Today we're going to speak about Christianity. It's going to be a religion series, and we're going to have no other than David, who has been here before. He had a talk about identity, and it was really, really interesting. So it's my absolute pleasure to welcome him back to another RFRX session. So David, thank you so much for joining us once again. And yeah, just welcome.
Thank you, Amaya. Hi, everybody. I'm already seeing the chat room is exploding all over the place, so that's awesome. Real quick from the beginning, so my name is David Teachout. I'm in the West Coast, and really this for me is as much of a dialogue as possible. So we definitely have a bunch of questions as a kind of outline, but really anything that comes up, if it fits in, great. If it doesn't, then yes, there is the Q&A afterwards, and I will be taking time to join for a while. We'll see how long, but I'll be there for a while afterwards, since I just love talking about this stuff. So real quick, as far as bona fides, I guess, are concerned. So I grew up in Michigan. And was originally going to be a minister for evangelical Christianity. Grew up Baptist, went Southern Baptist, for those that know about such things, and then went to college at Grace Bible College, what is now Grace University in Grand Rapids there, and was going to be a minister. And that didn't work out, which we'll get into a little bit later. But I still ended up graduating, kind of a dual focus on psychology and theology, because it was a Bible college, so I had to, you know, continue taking theology courses. Came out to Washington, and I've been here ever since, and have never really quite stopped studying religion in particular. But I will say that I will not be making any kind of statements concerning my expertise in Christianity, or really any religion in particular. I will say that there's a lot of resources that we can be found. I love talking about this stuff, and I've been looking at it for 20 plus years. So there's that. And beyond an academic thing, it is very much a personal matter as well, given what I came out of, and as well for probably most of you here. This is definitely a
thank you so much, David. So the first thing that we usually open the religion series with is, what's your coming out story of religion? Because most of the speakers that come to RFRX are in fact ex-religious people, so I believe you're not an exception in this case. So if you could just share as much as you're comfortable, you know, what was your coming out story? What was the process behind it and all that jazz?
Sure. So the story is all, it's just weird. So I'll say one thing right at the beginning. You know, some people out who are, you know, kind of listening here, you know, who may be have deconverted quite a while ago, that's the word that I often use, is that you often feel like you look in the mirror and go, I am everything that I used to hate, that I used to preach against. it's not as terrible this time, but these days, because it's been, say, I deconverted in 2001, November, to be exact, and there's some story with that, but it, but it's just funny. There are days where you just kind of go, especially when researching for this talk. There was definitely a few things where I'm like, wow, I really used to believe a lot of things and condemn pretty much everything that I now do, which was a little weird. So thankfully I'm a therapist, so I got to talk to myself through it. But I went to a Bible college. I grew up very religious. My family still is. My parents in particular, you know, definitely on the fundamentalist evangelical side. And so grew up like focused on the family. Moody Bible Institute was actually the college that I originally was going to attend, applied for before going to Grace. And so, you know, the idea of serving the Lord in every way imaginable, this was not just an idea, this was life. No joke. I mean, the quote unquote Bible was seen not just as a nice literature, it wasn't just even as a book to study for the faith, it was the truth of the universe. Like that's just what it was. So went to college and I had a history of being frankly a pain in the ass and just asking a lot of questions and not being very satisfied with simple answers. So I started studying presuppositional philosophy, apologetics, and other things around the age of 15, 16. I was actually, asked to leave a church because I was too conservative. I didn't fit in my youth group at the time, again, because I was calling out the youth group leaders as not holding standards. And I wasn't very nice about it either. I cringe a little bit in retrospect. So went off to college thinking, all right, so this is finally going to be a place where I'm going to be surrounded by people who care as much about studying these things as much as I do. No, that was not the case. And in fact, I almost didn't even attend Grace. I attended a weekend thing where you spent like a couple of days in classes and then you left on a Saturday kind of thing. And I was sitting there like, there's no way I'm going to go away for a year kind of thing. Maybe I'll go into mission work or something because I'm sitting here and all these students are doing, there was no joke, a death metal Christian dispensationalist rock band that was screaming very loudly. If you can follow all of those words, you get a prize. But yes, that was their thing. And I'm just sitting in the lobby just going, this is ridiculous. But at the time, I ended up meeting a couple of people who ended up being really good friends for many years. And that's what got me there. So pretty much relationships are at the core of the journey. But then kept asking more questions, studying, the theology, starting, a lot more of the history, looking at various theologies and the way systematic theology works. And started studying science. I know, bad. And got convinced of evolution, which then, of course, really screwed up the KJV only, very literal translation of the Bible that I had gotten into. So that didn't work really well. And finally, I was given a book called Atheism, the Case Against God, by George H. Smith, which I still actually recommend, is a great book. And I was given it first, took a year to study, came back to it, and within like a month, I was like 50 pages into the book, I'm like, I'm out, like this is, I'm done. And it just, everything just really coalesced. But unfortunately, I still had multiple years left of Bible college. and I didn't really think a lot of my credits would transfer. So I ended up staying and kind of playing the role of, you know, skeptical theist kind of thing. I learned later that I really didn't convince any of my professors. They were well aware that I was a heathen, but to their eternal credit, they really didn't make a big deal out of it. They gave me plenty of opportunity to study. They were really dedicated to the academic side of their faith. So as a consequence, I didn't get kicked out. That was it. So graduated and moved down out to Washington, which I was assured by people at the Bible College that it was a den of lesbian Wiccans. Unfortunately, I got out to Washington and no, that is not the case. Washington is not filled with lesbian Wiccans. So yeah, there's that, unfortunately.
Well, I didn't know that Washington was supposed to be but it's great to know. I'll note it for when I go to the US. Love to know that.
And I also,
and I also wasn't expecting you to be so conservative that even like the, you know, the leaders of your church were like, okay, you need to calm down. Like, I'm really curious to know, like, what were you saying for it to be that bad? But yeah, obviously you don't need to share it if it's that was, you know, too bad.
I joke that I was basically theologically speaking to the right of like Attila the Hun. I mean, it was there were like James Dobson didn't go far enough for me. Like it was really, really far right. There was, I think at one point in some of the particular theological circles that I was walking in, maybe 10% of Christians out there actually believe. I mean, it was just bizarre, but really got into mid-ex dispensationalism, which we can talk about if people really want to. Got into KJV only, which we can definitely, you know, talk about as well if people want. So it was really a very, very narrow isolationist thinking. Yeah, kind of crazy.
Yeah, no, that's okay. Thank you for sharing that. So the next question that we usually ask is a very, very brief history of the religion. So I'm sure a lot of people here will be aware of, you know, the history of Christianity, but I am not because I'm incredibly ignorant. So I will still pester David with, you know, tell me a bit about the history, but just very brief because obviously it's, you know, we don't want to have a full on history lesson, but just to give some context to the current religion.
Well, and I will say that I am not qualified to give an absolutely stellar history. If you really want to, and I know some of the resources I sent to Amaya, so I'm sure those will get shared. But for anybody interested, the story of Christianity by Justo Gonzalez, he has it in two volumes. Cannot recommend enough. It really, one, it's fabulously well written. He is a believer, so he makes no bones about it. He doesn't shy away from it. And in some ways, I actually appreciate that better because it shows up in his dedication to his historical academics. Like he really, there are multiple times in reading through those volumes that, and they're volumes, they're like 500 pages a piece, where he says things that make sense to him. And, you know, and as a believer, he already has an answer to it. But as a non-believer reading it, he has to say it because of his dedication to historicity. But then, but it really doesn't help the actual, story as far as an evangelical perspective. So it's just really well done. And it's quite a history. So without getting a whole lot of dates and names and so on, my focus really is about the themes that the history of Christianity embodied and still does in many ways. And that is one, a kind of peasantry to upper class. So at the time, very beginning, really the people that were being converted were the lowest of the low class, like not intellectuals, not wealthy. These were peasants. These were, the workmen of the time. And in fact, the term Christian was seen as a derogatory term precisely because it was seen as the faith of the moron. I mean, really, like, it was just like, none of you know what the hell you're talking about. You know, paganism at the time, at the very beginning, was, and by pagan, we don't mean what we mean now. Paganism at the time was like Greek philosophy. It was Plato, it was Aristotle. It was, all of these big thinkers that had come forward over the last several hundred years. And they were like going, okay, wait a minute. Here are these like massive minds that were trying to fathom the secrets of the universe. And here this new kind of mystery cult comes onto the scene who is filled with, the working class, to use a modern, phrase. And in making it even worse, they were often referred to as atheists because they had no physical God. It was invisible. So the pagans, which is pretty much everybody else, were looking at them going, you're really not believers. Like you don't have a God. This is fake. This is ridiculous. It's amazing what 2000 years will do to you. But a lot of these terms got switched around. And yes, Jeff, my, how things have changed. Yes, indeed. Although I remember a joke, I forget where I heard it from once, but basically all monotheists are just atheists one step removed. There is that. But during this whole process, Christianity evolved through a lot of, social unrest and politics. And the way it evolved was very much socially. So it started off, believers were, looking at themselves and dealing with in groups, meeting in houses. Now, during the persecutions, which were varied, not nearly, and this was actually one of the things that Gonzalez was really good about, is he had to stick with actual historical examples that could be verified as much as possible. So he couldn't declare that there was like 150 years of like absolute devastating persecution and everybody hated Christians. No, it really wasn't. It wasn't, cakewalk, but it wasn't a universal pogrom. It was often regionally done. Often it had more to do with financial disenfranchisement, removing people. Although, yes, there were, not to minimize it, quite a lot of death as well. And that, in fact, played a role a little bit later in different ways. But because of that, they ended up actually meeting in underground cemeteries, in mausoleums, is eventually where they kind of moved from the house and went into secret and were meeting in cemeteries, which really set the stage for, in many ways, social respect. Even a lot of the pagans at this time started, which is everybody else, started looking at Christians and going, you're willing to actually go through all of this, meet in secret, go through all these processes despite this. Like, okay, this is interesting. It was only later that they, you know, developed into churches, much later. This was post-Constantine later, when they were actually looked at as in any way kind of legitimate. And then, of course, during this whole time, there is this notion of theological development. So it's kind of a third theme. And that is, they wanted, you know, to get away from this notion of Christians being stupid and ignorant. And so as a consequence, there started being a lot of the earliest so-called church fathers, like Origen, Tertullian, and others, had come out of law school. They had come out of a lot of the philosophical academies, and they start going, okay, wait a minute. How can we better equip the believers? How can we spread the message to the pagan people better? And part of the way that they thought about doing this is going, okay, wait a minute. Maybe we can start seeing how Christianity fits within the history of philosophy. So rather than being like, contrary to, we started the notion of, wait a minute, you know, this is something that has been long with us for all of time. So, you know, they started the notion, this was actually Origen. He started the idea of, the overarching ideas from Plato being, in fact, God, the idea of forms and all this stuff. And so there was this movement of going, okay, wait a minute. So if this fits, maybe it fits in better. So there was this notion of God being part of the rest of the, you know, gods of paganism. And in fact, when Constantine so-called converted, he in fact never stopped giving sacrifices to the pagan gods. Never stopped. It was all the way until his deathbed before he ever actually even was baptized, and you know, this whole thing. And in fact, Gonzalez among others noted that in fact there were some church leaders that during Constantine's time that had to really call up and call out some Christians because they themselves were giving sacrifices to Constantine as a god. So it was like, wait a minute, no, this doesn't work, guys. It's not legit. So there was this whole notion of like, how does this all fit together? And so they were constantly struggling with this idea of, okay, we're a people set apart, which was very much taken out of Jewish history. And yet at the same time, as time went on, they become a centerpiece of society and what that comes with it. So Frank, you know, the idea of, the church under Constantine was given, you know, tax, abstention. So they didn't have to pay taxes. They were given a ton of land, which really started throwing in a lot of history later on, having ramifications for what we now look at as the Catholic Church and a lot of the money that they accrued, 1,000 years later. There was a notion of, what do we do now with all this pomp and circumstance? What do we do with the notion of the fact that now that we're the center, in their mind, of the Roman Empire, what does that do with the previous idea of the eventual return or the eventual bringing about of the kingdom of God, which was taken from Judaism? So instead they started switching it and saying, well, now that's been fulfilled. And that fulfillment is now in Constantine. We're all good. It's now time for us. So we had this kind of beginning ground of a lot of theological debates that we now kind of, talk about in certain circles, these days. And in fact, As Gonzalez, among others, notes, the whole notion of the end of times thinking, otherwise you looked at as eschatology, really went away for like 1,000 years. Like people just really weren't concerned with how the world ends and how things, you know, developed in that way for quite some time, because they thought really this is it, we're living already in it. The word was eschatology. There you go, spelled it. And so, and of course, during this whole time, you had a lot of, and I'm glossing over a ton. So you had a lot of controversy around theology. You had notions around, you know, the idea of who Jesus was. So you had the Arian controversy as to, you know, what whether or not Jesus was actually part of the Trinity. In fact, the notion of the Trinity, the notion of sin, the notion of, you know, the legitimacy of baptism, the idea of original sin or the role of women in church, all of these things weren't established for hundreds of years. You had the Council of Nicaea in 325, which started the idea of, and in fact, Nicaea was called to address concern over whether or not Jesus was divine. No joke. Like right up until, in fact, not until 381 at the Council of Constantinople was this question really kind of put to rest for the majority. And the, you know, so 350 years past, you know, however, which way you fall on the historicity of Jesus, but 350 years, post the common idea that he existed, they're still wondering, like, wait a minute, was this guy God? How does this work? And there's a lot of issues around why that was. There was political issues, there was social problems, and all of that. We can get into that more, you know, if people want. But suffice to say, I mean, these debates were something that were from the beginning and still are with us now. In fact, the other main one, which was called Docetism, which had to do with whether or not the church was supposed to be wealthy or whether it was supposed to look more monastic. They were debating it. I mean, so the Catholic Church as we see it, or even the Eastern Orthodox Church as we see it now, really was a debatable point. Like there was a huge, you know, quite a lot of people going, this is not what we're to be about. This is not helpful. In fact, the entire structure of the Catholic Church directly comes out of, you know, the fact that they took on the hierarchical structure of the Roman Empire. Like it's just in the trappings thereof. I mean, so much of this really is that problem, which we're still dealing with today in many ways, of this melding of politics or government and Christianity. And so it's really, the whole thing of it is that at the end of the day, you know, it's that constant struggle of going, okay, so what is the nature of belief? You know, when Christianity was small, for instance, in order to be socially labeled as a believer, you had a three years process to go through. So there's just, you know, so 3 years process to going up on, you know, what it would take. And in fact, by the end of the 3 years, that's when you were baptized, which by and large, most people were doing immersion, unless you didn't have, you know, running, you know, a source of water, because not everybody did. But, you know, it's the, And then of course, as time went on, that was fine. Like you could, if you had a small number of people converting in any given time in any given area, you could ask them to take 3 years of study and personal, you know, evolution to work through all of this. But as soon as you started having from like 5% of the empire to like 90% of the empire, well, suddenly you can't really be asking everybody to spend 3 years in study. So instead, it really evolved from, we're going to ask you to know all this, to simple declarations, which got, you know, opened up a whole other can of worms, because now you've got people, you know, and a whole bunch of questions as to, is it a behavior that's important? Is it, how important is the declaration? You had a lot of concerns over, here are people that had denied the faith under persecutions. And so, you know, are we allowing them to come back into the fold? Are we not? So all of this, you know, in many ways, reading history is a lot like just reading what's going on. You know, how many times have we heard, well, that's not a real Christian. You know, that's not what real Christians do. This was not a question that is modern. This is a question that's been around since, you know, 300, you know, literally 1700 years and longer. And there's just so much there that we can appreciate, if not find amusing at times. I think the favorite little tidbit, and then I'll, and that'll be it, is that there was, I guess, in the whole notion of whether or not priests and monks should be celibate, which at the very beginning was not a big deal, later on became, you know, a major issue. But so many people were literally like so incensed over removing themselves from the physicality as being sinful that they were castrating themselves. And it became such a big deal that they actually, the church as a whole, had to make a declaration of going, guys, you really need to stop doing this. You're not allowed to keep doing this. In fact, if you do, we're not going to let you become a priest. And which really, I think, was due to, it's kind of difficult to convert people when you start getting the notion or running around that you, you know, have to castrate yourself in order to get into it. So it was a bit of a, you know, PR problem, I think, at the time. But yeah, people are funny, and it really haven't changed much in 2000 years. So, yeah.
Another unexpected thing, the whole, you know, castration bit that I definitely wasn't aware of. But I'm kind of
a little shocked myself.
Yeah, it's one of those things that I feel like religious leaders try to not like share so much, because obviously lots of people would be like, fuck no, I'm not gonna do that for my religion. So yeah, that's good to know, but hopefully it's not practiced anymore, is it? Or maybe it is in like really, really close
cults. I mean, you can always find people who do bizarre things in the name of their faith. I mean, and by bizarre, of course, is by perspective. I mean, it's, you still have people in South America who to this day, given the fact we have Easter coming up, who participate in live crucifixions. No joke, full on nails through the feet and hands. You have people who are lining up to be the person who does this. It's really stunning. I mean, really, we in that kind of zealotry is Philippines too, absolutely. That kind of zealotry is something that the church, and I'm using this very loosely, but the church has dealt with, all, you know, back and forth for since its beginning. You know, what is, you know, when they were dealing with the monastic orders, like, wait a minute, are we all supposed to run into the desert and, you know, be almost like a Stoic ascetic, like, how does this work? Are we, you know, what, how are we to preach? You know, later on, you know, it's, you know, what is the degree of celibacy? How does, basically, how does any of this work? And you always had people who were declaring a, from a certain majority perspective, an extreme position. And yet from another perspective, they were simply looking at it as, no, we're just following through on the core principles better than you are. Mm-hmm. So, and really outside of certain very serendipitous social changes and, you know, and political changes, everything that we know of today would just simply not be. Like, it just wouldn't be here. In the way that we look at it, it's really crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the next question that we usually have is, what are the different sects of the religion? And I think with Christianity, it can be especially challenging because, I mean, Christianity has so many different versions, and I feel like each year there is like a new one that comes up that kind of takes over. A bunch of people, and to be completely honest, I'm only like aware of very, very few, very, very basic ones. So obviously we wouldn't be able to cover every single you know, sect that exists within Christianity, because we will have to have like a separate session for each sect. But just as a brief overview, can you give us like the most common different sects, or the most interesting? Because I mean, if there is any that, you know, do the whole castration things, I'd love to know, especially to avoid it and to, you know, discourage anyone from joining. But yeah, if there is any interesting ones or the main ones that you can talk about.
Basically, there's so many. But generally, and so, like I just mentioned, I'm using the term the church very generally. So there's, of course, the three main, which you could look at as Catholic, Protestant, and Eastern Orthodox. The history of why Catholic and Eastern Orthodox developed their own path is really, from a historical perspective, fascinating. It really, really interesting how that has gone and why it continues, and why they are different, and the why they each have a different power in society, at least during certain periods of time. So Protestantism, you know, itself gets broken down into any number of what, you know, referred to as denominations, could also be referred to as, you know, sects. I never pronounce it very well because I have a bit of a lisp. So S-E-C-T-S. So, and so you have everything from, you know, the initial groups, Anglicans, Lutherans, which stemmed very much from the initial Protestant revolution, as I affectionately refer to it as, and or Protestant rebellion, as it was referred to by some at the time, which you had, of course, Martin Luther in the kind of almost social mythology of stapling those 95 theses to the wall. Not quite what happened, but it's a nice story. So you had this breakup, which was as basically as close as possible to Catholicism. There was just these few things that really wanted to be changed. And then, you know, the floodgates opened up, frankly, with the printing press. Once you started being able to give, in fact, the warning was done at the time that if you, I forget who predominantly said it, but there were multiple, you know, at the time we were stating, like, you give the so-called Bible to the masses, you will have as many groups as there are, you know, believers. And sure enough, you can pretty much do that. And so you have everybody from, you know, Baptists to Anabaptists to Southern Baptists to Grace Gospel Fellowship, you know, and people of varying sizes of groups and so on, all based on various issues of whether or not there should be deacons, whether or not women can serve in the church at all, or whether or not women are okay to serve, but they can't be in positions of leadership. You have issues around the role of baptism. You know, should you sprinkle? Should you be total immersion? Do you need to baptize at all? You have issues around, you know, you have the Pentecostals. So, you know, the one that is, you know, often, particularly when leaving Christianity, easy to poke fun at. You know, you have the talking in tongues and, you know, the people falling on the floors, which is really a bit of a caricature. So I will throw that out there, but it's not completely false. But you had all this stuff, you know, it's just like, so you have all these groups who from the very beginning tie themselves to particular aspects of what they believe is in, you know, an interpretive way of looking at the Bible, and then ran with it, and they got enough people together and now they've got their own denomination. But it's all based on, and here's the question, of course, for, you know, one of the things that got me questioning was, so you have all of these groups die hard telling each other that this is, you know, you're full of it, nope, you're full of it, nope, you're wrong, and they're all using the exact same book. Who'd have thunk? And then, of course, on top of that, and here's a here's a fun little history thing on that. So the notion of the Trinity, in fact, which, you know, many times, you know, the rejoinder to all of these, you know, debates or is going, well, you have all these people who disagree with each other, is that, but the core doctrines are what we all agree on. Well, I would think that how one becomes saved is a pretty core doctrine, and not everybody agrees with that. But on the other hand, even the notion of the Trinity really wasn't solidified until 381 in, you know, as I mentioned before, as far as the Council of Constantinople. And in fact, at the Council of Nicaea, so the notion of, you know, the Nicene Creed was developed because they wanted an idea, they wanted to combat Arianism, which was the idea that Jesus as Word, as the Word, was itself not part of God, was a created entity. Granted, he was created entity prior to all of the rest of the creation, but still a created entity. And to combat that, they came up with a creed. But they came up with it because even at the time, they knew that the strength of the argument wasn't strong enough from the Bible itself. So they had to come up with a universalized statement to that was logically sound to make their point. So it's like, even from the very beginning, you know, some of these, you know, doctrines that people just absolutely believe are bedrock principles that everybody's always believed, just not true. You know, this was a developed process, fascinating from a sociological perspective, but a developed process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for sharing that, David. I have absolutely no idea. So I know you spoke about a bit of what do Christians believe in, and, you know, for example, the concept of original sin and all of that, but could you develop a bit more on what sort of beliefs distinguish Christianity from other religions? Like, what do Christians believe in? And also, how is it organized in sense of, I know that in certain versions of Christianity, like the Pope is a very relevant figure, but not so much in others. So if you could explore that a little bit.
Yeah. So, so many things. So the way I tend to frame it is, and in fact, this was a bit instrumental in my own deconversion, because I actually got a little bit into the study of Catholicism for a time, just going, okay, I'm not finding the answers in broad Protestant circles. So maybe you can find it here. Like, they've been around for a long time. They seem to have it. They don't. But it was really interesting getting into. And then, of course, 9/11 happened. And if anybody caught my deconversion date, November of 2001, so a few, couple months after 9/11. So 9/11 happened. And up until then, you know, I'd been, you know, had already established a lot of, you know, the science bona fides, had already started evolution, started questioning literalism. And started going, okay, so here we have a group who is, I mean, let's face it, quite dedicated to their particular version of a religion, who are more than willing to die in its name. And the inevitable question came up, particularly for somebody who, you know, in a peak of religious arrogance thought, oh yeah, I would totally become a martyr for my faith. Of course, it's easy to say when you live in, you know, Western United States in a city where, you know, everybody, every third person believes like you do. But, you know, but you can say it, you can say it proudly. And so, you know, the question then came up, like, okay, wait a minute, what is giving them their fervency? What's giving them their purpose? And started studying Islam a bit more and started going, okay, wait a minute. So most of the arguments that I would use against Islam also apply to Christianity. Well, shoot, that's not helpful. So really, you know, that was another, you know, kind of step down that path. But you have the big three, of course, where you, big three, which I'm going to note right away, I'm saying the big three from a very Western perspective. as far as adherents are concerned in history, Buddhism, Hinduism, and it's all its various sects far outnumber everybody else, and have been along for quite a lot bit longer. So there's all of that. But even that, you have a difference in, I'm going to try really hard to not get too deep into philosophy here. But you basically have a difference of opinion as to what is the fundamental nature of the universe. And so you have various dualisms that are going on. What is the nature of the spiritual reality or the supernatural? And all of that stems from. Then you have the big three as far as like the middle world to Western civilization of, you know, Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. You know, the two stem from Judaism. It just depends on what they do with it. And it depends on what your holy book is and what your primary leader is, you know, so, depending on the religion, of course, is your, you know, version of what God is, which was always fun as an atheist, for the first few years is like, do you believe in God? And I would always often respond with which one, like define first. So we don't just assume that we're all speaking about the same thing. In fact, that was also an issue with the Bible as well. It's like, which one are you talking about? Many of the versions disagree with one another. So that's always fun. But you have, you know, anything from, so what's the fundamental nature of reality? What is the nature of God? What is the nature of salvation? What's the nature of humanity? You know, is there a notion of eternal, of, you know, is the physicality evil? And what does that look like? You know, not everybody has a notion of original sin. So also interesting. In fact, even Catholic Church didn't always have the notion of original sin. So you can imagine just as a tangent there for a moment, the sheer amount of suffering over the last 2000 years that could have been avoided by not having that doctrine went out is stunning to me, just as a side note. Anyway.
I love when you were saying about, you know, how do you define God and all that stuff? It kind of reminded me a bit of Jordan Peterson, who can like redefine anything to mean anything, and therefore just create the meaning from the ground up, like completely make up everything and just make it make sense in a way, because there is so, there is not enough to ground your beliefs in, because the Bible is so inconsistent and there's so many different versions. So, you know, you can come up with completely weird ideas on what it means, you know, to be a believer, what it means, what does God mean? Is it a concept? Is it a real thing, or, you know, a tangible thing? What is it exactly? So, yeah, I find that really, really interesting. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. And then we would like to know, what are the specific struggles that people in this religion face? Because obviously, you know, each religion comes with its struggles and its problems, but what are the specific ones that you would say are more related to Christianity? And also, how can we help people coming out of Christianity?
Good question. So by and large, I will look at the struggles that are fairly unique to Western civilization. Christianity definitely shows up with different struggles depending on where you are in the world. There are still Christians killing Christians in Africa, India. You know, this is not exactly something that most of us here in the States really have to worry about. I mean, you might not get the brisket at the local church potluck if you don't belong to their group, but you're not going to have your house burned down and your family slaughtered. So yay. You know, that's a win. So, you know, so this is very much here, and putting it in context as well, as far as, you know, the, how all of that works, and really, you know, as much of the struggles are that we have here, really could be worse. And it's not to ignore the struggles that go on here. It's just, wow. Thankfully we have come a long way. But the, you know, here, you know, there's the biggest question, frankly, which has continued from the very beginning. What is women's role? You know, the whole notion of original sin being referred to eventually as Eve's sin is itself one of the most catastrophically horrible ideas that has ever been created, pretty much right alongside the original sin notion itself, but has resulted in a host of sociological ideas about women's inferiority, you know, leadership, the so-called weaker sex ideas, and so on. And as a flip side as well, the, what that then means for men is this notion of, you know, in the burdens of what that then means of being head of household, of being looked at as, you know, the very notion of men being the breadwinners likely has some, you know, has at least a variable connection, you know, to this. So you have a whole bunch of social issues that we're still struggling with to literally this day, that is stemming from, you know, how Christianity has been interpreted by and large. As far as deconverting is concerned, man, if you're, particularly if you're already in a sexual minority and you're deconverting, I can only tell you help is out there. And there are people in groups that are there to support you. There are far too many, teenagers in particular who have been removed from their homes, and have no resources. Because of, you know, their identity and, you know, in how they look at themselves and who they believe themselves to be, and if on the basis of sex and sexual attraction. And it is, frankly, an atrocity that it continues. So you have those issues, you have threats, you still have issues around people being killed, not per se around whether or not you belong to a particular version of Christianity necessarily, at least here, but certainly, you know, I remember, you know, hearing, there was a sermon, I think it was Dobson. It may have been, I forget. Anyway, but it was back during, I think it was Clinton's days, in which at the time I was still very much a believer. And he was talking about and alluded to in his nationally broadcast sermon about basically praying for the death of the Supreme Court justices. And he kind of, and he alluded to it, he didn't call out for it because he knew better. But it was obvious. And he, in fact, it was so obvious that he actually had to stop for a moment and go, that's not really what I'm meaning. And everybody kind of laughed along with him because they knew what he really meant. And on the face of it, it's absurd. Like on the face of it, you just kind of go, really, you're gonna, you know, mind talk to an imaginary being and get him to start killing people. And it's not, you know, it's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is that it is a socially acceptable, in some circles, way of mitigating one's desire to commit horrible acts. There are still stories that occur, and not going to get into, you know, all of the, you know, the mental health issues that often probably are involved. But, you know, stories of roommates getting murdered by the roommate when they find out that they're an atheist. You know, families killing their own kids because they heard the voice of God. And things just, thankfully, it's not a normal occurrence. Even most believers these days look at that and go, that is not right. And frankly, that just shows the absolute power of modern morality, because even people who fundamentally should disagree with its basis can't help but go, actually, this is a pretty good idea. So, but so you deal with threats, you deal with isolation, you deal with a kind of social versions of pogroms. There's also, frankly, just a loss of purpose, depending on how extensive your belief structure was, how pervasive it was for guiding various aspects of your life. It can be devastating, absolutely shattering, to wake up one morning, so to call it, so to speak, and recognize that, wait a minute, the last 20, 10, 20, 30 years of my life has been based on maybe not a lie particularly, but a deception. And worse, that I deceived myself in it. Like, it's not even like when you're younger, you can almost point, you know, put it at, well, you can blame my parents, you can blame society or whatever. But as you get older and you leave, there's that, the pressure, the responsibility starts looking at and going, no, I've been doing this to myself for this long. That can be really just frankly damning, to use it in a secular word. And there's a power to why then you don't leave. I mean, I know RFR and other organizations are related to the sheer number of pastors and ministers out there who are, yeah, they're not believers anymore. But there's no way they can leave. They've got family. They've got social standing. They've got bills to pay. And so they go about their lives. And I think, you know, at the, when I first deconverted, it means, you know, there's, you know, what's the, there's no greater proselyte than the sinner. Well, let me tell you, there is no greater zealot for atheism than the recently deconverted. And so, you know, it's easy to condemn the people who haven't left. And yet over time, there's an appreciation for the pressures that so many are under for that. Yeah, that gets personal. Anyway, so, but yeah, loss of sense of purpose, the fact that some of these doctrines, this is actually the part I'll end on here, is that, you know, certain doctrines like original sin, one's relationship to one's own sexuality, both in identity and actions, still continue to play a role. You may have left it in a kind of headway, but you have not truly left it in the whole of who you are. And it has been, see, 2001, so it'll be 20 years here in 8 months since leaving. And there are still moments where the notion of sin comes up. You know, there's still, you know, moments in which, you know, death anxiety, what's on the other end of it? Am I going to get to the other side, so-called, and have Jesus going, oops, you screwed up, you're done, welcome to everlasting torment. Still there. Like, it really never quite fully leaves you, again, depending on the degree to which, you know, is, you know, within your life. But yeah, influences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you, David. I've always been quite fascinated by how Christianity have managed to, like, make so many people believe in it whilst also being so incredibly discrimination, like, I was going to say a word that doesn't exist, but basically discriminating so many different minorities, pretty much anything that's not a white cis man, essentially, like anything that's not that, and heterosexual, of course. Then it's like completely, just not accepted, and you should pretend to be someone else, which is always fun and great for your mental health. So,
and that point itself, sorry, that point itself is why, like, when you study history, none of the early church fathers and so on were white. I mean, it's just like the history of Christianity is not the history of whiteness. You know, it is the history of an idea that had multiple ideas that was pervasive across multiple cultures and people. You know, it one of the most pernicious, and it's not that many people don't try to spread this BS, having recently run into actual white supremacists, not the white supremacists that are, hey, I disagree with you, therefore you are one. But, you know, real ones who are like, no, we're the supremacy of the white race, whatever the heck that means. They're as much of a denial of history as anybody else is. And the sheer number of, cultures and variations in skin color and so on that were involved in the creation of Christianity is stunning. It is absolutely stunning and really should not be ignored. In fact, you know, anytime being able to push back on it is just, this is just pure revisionism. This is a fantasy that is as much a fantasy as, you know, Daniel going up on, you know, the chariot of fire. I mean, it just, the whole thing is just absurd. And yet it's peddled by way too many people. Anyway, sorry, that was a recent issue that came up in a conversation a couple weeks ago, and it's just got me all like, ah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, yeah, feel free to rant as much as you need. So, a question that I guess isn't necessarily on the list, but what I'm curious about is, what sort of techniques does Christianity use to lure people in? Because I feel like if you're born into Christianity, then fair enough, you know, that's what you know. But if you are a new person, which is, you know, being introduced to the religion, what sort of techniques do they use in order to attract new people?
You know, it's interesting looking back through the history is that The techniques haven't changed. Most people still get or come across and be converted by normal people. I mean, the vast majority of the initial believers were not being brought over and leaving paganism to varying degrees because of the power of argumentation. It wasn't even the power of necessarily fear or salvation, because those doctrines weren't fully developed right at the beginning. So those came later and have definitely played a role. But initially, it was your Joe Schmo, you know, carpenters and you know, your average person. That's why there was such a push to develop a kind of intelligentsia of Christianity about 200 onward, is because they were looked at as, this is a joke of a thinking process or an ideology. And that still largely happens. I mean, most people today, adventure, are not coming across Plantinga and going, yes, I'm totally enraptured by the philosophical joy of this, you know, writing. No, you know, nobody's coming across J.L. Mackey and going, yes, I understand that ethics are truly impossible without a divine source. It's not, no, most people are, you know, coming up with a civic faith. You know, it's my parents were, my friends are, I had a good time at church camp where you were basically drugged up with sugar cookies and, you know, late night fire chats and got up early. So you're pretty much sleep deprived, high on sugar, and bound into a social experiment of teenage horniness. And you go, oh yeah, if Jesus is this, let's go with it. I mean, and it's Bible camps are so much fun. Yes, they were. And, you know, in some of it, it's difficult. Like, the cynical part of me looks at a lot of these tactics and goes, this is some kind of deep Machiavellian strategy. No, like, most of the time, that's not it. They're just going, how can we, you know, reach people and make things interesting based on this truth that we deeply feel? And you're like, okay, well, how do we go about doing this? Well, let's put together camps and let's put together big experiences and let's tie food and fellowship to it. What do we all want? Relationships. We want to be seen. We want to be heard. We want to belong. And so fundamentally, those are the strategies. And now over the course of history, you know, the strategies have shifted in focus. The idea of, you know, fear, salvation, really at its core is about ostracism, is about being denounced from the community. Ostracism itself has been a time-honored tactic well beyond religious circles to castigate people. So what's the worst thing you could happen in, you know, initial tribal humanity? Well, you get cast from the circle because you're probably going to die. So kind of, they don't even have to kill you. This is just terrible. And Jack, good point in the chat there. Huxley's great on that. So there are a lot of different tactics. You know, there's deathbed conversions, you know, there, which, you know, effectively there's the, you know, here's the, you know, wouldn't you rather, like, isn't this great anyway? So even if you're wrong, why is this a problem? You know, kind of thing. You know, it's, but even then, it all comes down to wanting to feel Pascal's wager. Thank you, Jeff. I can't believe I blank on that. Probably because I haven't used that wager in quite a long time. But it really, all of it is really all about socialization. It's belonging. And so while you might have variations on fear and manipulation and so on, you know, it all really ends up being, you know, coming down to, you know, isn't this great over here? The grass is in fact greener on the other side. So come on over and join us.
Thank you, David. Is there anything else you want to say before we go to the Q&A? Any topic you want to touch on?
I think lastly, look at is when leaving, because it's tricky, is some of the things to help out with is that because so often the conversion tactics are about community, that's one of the first things to find, which is why I love RFR. Just do a plug for you guys, is the fact that this really is about building community. This is about a recognition that we are inherently social creatures, and having left what we believe is the source of our meaning and purpose, here's where we can continue to find, you know, a place for our voice to be heard. And so really finding a community. Determine how to find your values and your purpose and meaning outside of Christian structure, which in fact was the last thing I talked about the last time I was here. But there is quite possible to find an ethic outside of a supernatural religious structure. And which brings into ethics and meta-ethics. How do you think about your well-being? Recently, I've gotten totally hooked on the CBS show Navy SEALs. And because David Borean has, I mean, awesome, because he's originally Angel and it's awesome. Anyway, nerding out for a moment. But there's a character in it who, his name is Ray. And he, in the second season, he ends up going through this crisis of faith. Because at a moment he, during a battle, he ends up denying the last rites to this drug lord. Complicated. Anyway, and he feels awful about it because here he is. He's basically, in order to get information from him, he denied him his last rites and then he died before he could go through it. So it's like he's pretty much condemned this man to, you know, damnation, all for to serve his country. And you're like, oh my gosh, this is awful. And so this whole thing evolves where he really starts doubting who he is and his morality and who he is as a father and a husband and all this stuff. And you see him devolve into this. And in many ways, you know, it was a testament to the power of faith and a power in the power of religious ideology, because it really was, it was a good portrayal of when you have lost what you believe is the cornerstone and the structure of finding meaning and ethics, to lose it can result in some serious behavioral changes. Now, the fact that generally outside of Hollywood, those changes aren't usually that drastic is a testament to our own kind of internal ethic, but that's another issue. But he found his way, you know, into his a new version of who he was as a person by, again, coming back to his own community. And it was, you know, interesting story. And lastly, don't be afraid of finding a new sense of, and I'll use the term spirituality or transcendence. The term is not inherently evil. There are any number of variations on it. And have fun with it to a degree. You know, it's, you know, there is a whole lot of things out there to explore. And, you know, it's the not losing sight of mystery, which can still very much be found in, you know, science and the study, you know, in how that is a way of looking at the world. Say it's one of the reasons why one of our first books, Leaving the Church, is Sagan. But continuing to have that sense of wonder, in figuring out where you're going to find it again, is really helpful.
That's amazing. Thank you so much, David. I really enjoyed the talk, especially the weird things that different sects do that's always so fascinating to me. The castration thing is still on my mind. Cannot ignore it at all, but yeah. So yeah, thank you so much. So without further ado, we're going to jump to the Q&A. So if anyone has any questions, please do write them in the chat, and Madeline and myself will collect them, and then we will ask them to David. So the first question that we have today is the Mormon religion considered mainline Christianity?
Ooh, good question. Yes and no. It's not expert in Mormonism, but recollection serves. Basically, you have the notion that Jesus appeared again to the indigenous tribes, and he came across documents and ran with it. Really. So you're like, okay. So there are many, it's in some ways, it's almost like you can see a lot of Christianity in Judaism, just like you can see a lot of Judaism in Islam. You can see a lot of Christianity in Mormonism or Jehovah's Witnesses for that matter. Jehovah's Witnesses are always fun. So they take the 144,000 of true believers that are going to go onward from like Revelation 8 or something. I forget exactly where that's from. And then gloss over the fact that in that same verse that there's 144,000, because it's 12,000 from each of the tribes of Israel, that they were all male and they were all virgins. So, whatever. Still the 144. But yeah, kind of fun. So there is some. I tend to refer not to call Mormonism and others cults, simply because it's a personal thing if you want to, whatever. But I prefer, I usually don't, because, they're one person's cults, another person's religion kind of thing. And they're all just trying to figure out meaning based on, frankly, bad principles. So, it's kind of where you left.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I remember I was watching this documentary on Netflix about the bomb, about some bombs in Mormonism. And I remember just being so like confused at the first episode, because they said that someone came up with this idea that the founder of Mormonism found a salamander or something like that. And that is what led him to discover, the true documents of the god or whatever, and instead of the salamander, it was something else. It was like he has found it on between some trees, and I was like, how is this, like, both are equally as unbelievable, like how is this such a big issue? But obviously, yeah, murder, I mean, among the Mormons, exactly. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I remember in one of my classes back in Bible college days, where we came across the Gnostic Gospels and the other stories of Jesus that were around, that actually were read for quite a while in church services. But, for instance, the Gospel of Thomas. And there was a story that it was like the idea being that, Jesus at one point basically took a pie and like birds came out of it or something. And the idea was, well, that's just ridiculous. And of course, one of the students in the class was like, so how is that any more ridiculous than rubbing mud on somebody's eyes and curing blindness? Like, really, where is the line that we're gonna draw here? To his credit, the professor was, he's like, I don't know. So. This is an honest point there, but yeah.
Oh, bless him. Madeline, I'll let you take the second question, if that's okay.
So the next one is asking whether Jesus was an Essene, like his cousin John, and I did have to look that up, but if you can speak to that, that'd be great.
That is a debate. I will put out my own very, very individual limited opinion here. So this is not definitive. The likelihood is that he probably was. Now, part of what's going on is that during the time in which Jesus likely existed, I do tend to gravitate towards the idea that somebody of that name or something probably did exist, was that there were many other people who were going around preaching a coming kingdom. And so trying to figure out who was correct is anybody's guess, and frankly had far more to do with the quality of their social connections. And here's, so came across, I think it's in the resources, it's called The Myth Maker, Paul and the Origins of Christianity, if I recall correctly. Written by a Jewish scholar that really pointed out that, frankly, if anybody, Paul himself was probably not a Pharisee, but in fact, Jesus probably was. Because the only way for him to have been considered a teacher, which is also why he was probably married, by the way, is that he, you know, had to stand up and in fact show others the quality of his scholarship. And so, and he had to show not only the quality of his scholarship, but he had to show a uniqueness to his own vision. Hence where probably, having belonged to at the time, relatively radical, sect of Judaism, like the Essenes were, probably gave him some pretty decent bona fides. As to the truth of it, your guess is as good as mine, and there are probably far better minds than my own that have delved into that.
All right, thank you.
You say that at the same time. Thank you so much, David.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.